Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Since 2012, Curious City, a reporting project and podcast based in Chicago, has been on the case to answer their community's questions about the what, why, how, and when of the Windy City. Listeners pitch the Curious City reporters questions they have, like why for sale signs are banned in particular neighborhoods, or how did Chicago come to have so many alleys? And then the Curious City reporters go and find that answer. A burning question about the Bay Area that I've been carrying around for years is, why aren't developers in San Francisco designing new buildings to look more like the Victorian architecture the city has become known for? I was so pleased to see that the team at Curious City recently took that subject on. Though their findings pertain to a different city, this investigation gave me a more informed perspective on how I view architecture around the Bay Area today, and probably for years to come.
When were the...
What school's the...
Who decides what the next...
Where's that story?
Why they keep the loop?
What is this?
It's Curious City.
Where WBEZ answers your questions
about Chicago, the region, and its people.
Hey, this is Jesse Dukes, audio producer with Curious City.
And I'm Jen Mason-Garb of the Chicago Architecture Foundation, where I'm the director of interpretation and research.
So Curious City and the Chicago Architecture Foundation have a partnership. We've been working together for a couple years now to answer questions about architecture and the built environment. And this question stands out. It's different than some of the other ones we've taken on. It comes from Rachel Glick, who recently moved to Oak Park. Let's hear it.
Well, I was wondering, if this historic architecture in Chicago is so celebrated and everyone thinks it's so beautiful and wonderful, why didn't they continue designing in that beautiful, wonderful way?
Jen, you really wanted to answer this question. Why?
For several reasons. One is that this is a question we get a lot at the Chicago Architecture Foundation, and our docents deal with this a lot on all of the thousands and thousands of tours that we give every year. It's a fascinating question because architects throughout history have constantly dealt with this question. What should our building look like?
And Rachel's question, it sort of suggests some biases, right?
It definitely
she
does.
She says these beautiful buildings right. of the past suggest she doesn't like more contemporary buildings. What did you want to challenge Rachel to understand?
I think one of my goals with her, but also with our audiences in general, is not to necessarily convince you that something is good or bad, but to help you understand why it looks the way it does. If you can understand the rationale of what the architect was trying to do, you're going to appreciate it in a different way.
Huh. Let's get a sense of what Rachel means when she says beautiful.
So, she's got strong opinions.
Yes. We met her a few weeks ago at the intersection of Michigan and Wacker. We were looking across the Chicago River at a couple of buildings from the 1920s that we knew she felt were beautiful. And the first voice we'll hear is you, Jen.
So we're looking across the river at the Wrigley Building, this kind of creamy white terracotta building with a clock tower at the top. And then we're also looking at the Tribune Tower, light-colored limestone building with flying buttresses and all sorts of Gothic Revival filigree up at the top. So as you stand here and look at these two buildings, what makes you smile? Why do you think these are beautiful?
These two have many different tiers. They have different levels and different shapes throughout the whole building, from bottom to top. And then there's tons of details. There's round windows and square windows, and it's just, it looks like a Gothic church. It's beautiful.
Basically, her question is, why don't we just copy the style of the Wrigley Building and the Tribune Tower over and over again? And so to answer, over the course of a couple of weeks, we visited a bunch of buildings with Rachel.
And I thought each of these would offer a different aspect to answering the question.
Yeah, and you started us off at the formerly known as IBM Building, now the AMA Plaza, just a few blocks away from the Wrigley and the Tribune. Why?
The design of the IBM Building represents a backlash against those historical buildings that Rachel actually does like. It was a building that was designed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe in 1969. Mies van der Rohe and the other contemporaries of his time had a radically different idea about what architecture should look like. Rather than seeing history as a way to sort of give your buildings validity or solidity or
timelessness,
right? They're seeing all that extra stuff that you might put on the building, all those connections to the past, as a burden.
They wanted something that had no extra applied ornamentation. To their minds, what made the building beautiful was the materials that you chose and also the way that you put the materials together. So the steel and the glass and the concrete. Rather than seeing the building like mass, like a solid thing that you're carving out of, they were thinking about buildings like a volume, like a glass of water.
Okay, so at this moment, Jen, you asked Rachel to look at the formerly known as IBM building, and she doesn't really seem to see what you see in it.
This is more kind of like this glass of water, right?
Kind of, but I don't really see it as glass of water just because it, to me, it's heavy. It's all black.
It's a little more transparent.
Yeah. I can see it's more transparent. It's one thinner. Word might be flimsy.
Could be.
Flimsy.
Could be.
So is she buying it?
Yeah, no, she is not convinced at all. But we wanted to investigate another building, a more contemporary building.
We went to the Spertus Institute. It's at 610 South Michigan, finished in 2006. And we met one of the architects who designed the building, Mark Sexton of Crook & Sexton. Let's let Rachel set the scene.
It's a very modern building. It looks like it's completely made of glass. And it's just wedged in between some of the most historic architecture in Chicago. But it's really interesting angles on the glass. It's a series of triangles and other interesting shapes that protrude from the building and go back into the building, and it's almost like a bent-up sail made of glass.
Neat. Do you like it?
I do. I actually like it.
She does. She likes this new building. I thought it was important for Rachel to hear from a living architect who's wrestling with these questions today about what a building should look like. Mark Sexton is an architect whose philosophies, I think, are strongly influenced by Mies van der Rohe. He's part of that same lineage.
And Mies van der Rohe is the one who designed those buildings that Rachel didn't particularly care for.
Exactly. And Mark is also an architect who cares deeply about aesthetics. And so when we were inside the building, I wanted him to answer this hypothetical question. Mark, let's say that Spertus had come to you and said, we'd like you to design the new center, but we want it to really sort of mimic that historic building down the street by Daniel Burnham built at the beginning of the 20th century. Can you do that? What would you have said?
I would think that there's probably another architect that could do it better. So I would say we probably would not have taken it, because my view is you don't build buildings like you did 100 years ago, because the performance of a building, the expectation of that performance from an energy, from a use, and from flexibility is just so much higher and different than it was when those buildings were built.
Wait, so then are you saying that, say, the building next door to us is going to cost a lot more money to heat? What are the practical distinctions?
Well, perfect example. Next door, it's most likely a steel building that is actually then covered in masonry. That masonry wall, it may be 18 inches or 20 inches in thickness. As we stand here at this building, the depth of our facade is about 1.25 inches. So the difference between 18 or 20 inches and 1.25 inches, because we use glass here, over the whole course of a building adds a lot of value.
Literally more square footage for offices or gallery space,
exactly.
Or what have you.
Yeah.
It's very cool. I like the building.
I think she's coming around. I think hearing from a living architect was probably helpful. And I think she's also realizing that with the same palette of materials, you can do different things, right? Because Mark is also designing in steel and glass and concrete, just as Mies was designing in steel and glass and concrete.
Mm.
Certainly, there are architects and developers today that choose to design buildings that borrow from the past or even mimic the past.
Mark's not one of them.
Mark is not one of them. No, no. But to make a building look like a different era costs more.
Okay, so you talked to Rachel about this historic shift to modernism in the middle of the 20th century, moving to different materials and getting rid of ornamentation. And we've heard from Mark Sexton at Spertus about this idea of performance and how contemporary materials allow him to get more value out of the buildings he designs. And it seems like she gets all that, but when it comes to those 1950s and 60s steel and glass buildings, do you feel like you ever got through to her?
Well, I really wanted to let Rachel see how modernists like Mies van der Rohe see beauty. And for them, that beauty is in the materials and the way the materials are put together. And so the best place to see that, I think, is at Mies' Federal Center. This open plaza in between these three federal buildings, all designed by Mies van der Rohe in the 1960s and into the 1970s. And these are all black and steel buildings.
Just like the ones she didn't like.
Just like the ones she didn't like. The ground is covered by these granite pavers. And I wanted her to look closely at the seams of these granite pavers that kind of create this grid, almost as if the three buildings were built on a sheet of graph paper.
Okay, let's hear how it went.
And if you look at the seam here, follow your eye this way. And where does the seam go?
Wow. It goes right into a pillar or the beam.
A column. Yep, and not only does it go to the column, it goes where to the column?
Directly middle.
Right to the middle of the column, right? Okay, now look at this seam.
Oh, wow, that one does too. The next seam goes right to another column.
Right, okay. Follow your eye this way.
Oh, okay. To the middle of a column.
To the middle of that column, right.
Yeah. And this one's across the street.
Across the street, yeah. So these three buildings, there's this harmony between them because everything lines up with everything. The light fixtures, the columns. Like, look at this corner here. Like, so this is a steel column. This welding here, have you ever done any welding?
No.
It's, like, hard. And it's really hard to make it look good. And this is kind of what I was getting at earlier, like, this craftsmanship of how one material is joined to another is what the modernists were fascinated with.
Well, I will say, I can definitely appreciate this. Like, I still don't think it's the most uplifting, wonderful feeling or color or look.
Regardless of whether you like this or not, is there anything that, you know, going forward you're going to be looking at more when you look at a modern building?
Definitely. I mean, one, I'll be considering, like, oh, which era is that from? And what were they thinking at the time? And I still have my feelings about several buildings, but at least the 50s and 60s buildings I can appreciate. There is a beauty in it.
How does that make you feel?
I'm happy. I'm happy that there's hints of there about sort of appreciation, and I think that's what it's about.
Well, reporting this week came from me, Jesse Dukes.
And me, Jen Masongarb.
Who comes to Curious City, courtesy of the Chicago Architecture Foundation.
Where our mission is to help you discover why design matters.
Support for Curious City comes from the Doris and Howard Conant Fund for Journalism. And by the way, the next time you look up in Chicago and see some detail on a building that looks weird or funny or ugly, go to wbez.org/curiouscity and ask us a question about it. Maybe we can help you appreciate it, just like Rachel.
It looks like a little tacky. Like, if it was a teeny little children's toy model, it wouldn't be so bad. Yeah, I'm still not a huge fan of it.
Or maybe not.
Check out more stories from Curious City, including one about whatever the heck a moldorama is, at curiouscity.wbez.org. And just like WBEZ has Curious City, KALW has Hey Area. If you have a question about the Bay Area that you've always been curious about, ask us at KALW.org. Look for Hey Area on the homepage, leave your question there, and a KALW reporter might go on the hunt to find the answer. See what local mysteries we've already uncovered by searching KALW.org for Hey Area. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. The next story focuses in on just one building. Past the brick walls and the windows, through the offices, down the hall, and then settles on one particular set of doors. The historical podcast, The Memory Palace, has arranged passage for us on one special elevator, which stops for a story on every floor.
Elevators are old. They would have to be, because it is in our nature, right? To rise. So history, even ancient history, is thick with things that lift other things. Ropes and platforms and weights and pulleys, with people to pull them. When the slaves of Rome were served up to the wild beasts at the Colosseum, other slaves pushed the wheels that pulled the ropes that lifted the platforms, that sent them up from the darkness below ground, up into the sun and the roar of the crowd, and of the lions. In China, in Hungary, in Mont Saint-Michel, one can find monks and kings and courtesans and construction materials and meals fit for queens and sordid consorts rising up, while some slave or servant or caged animal somewhere pulled on some rope or pushed some piece of wood around and around and around. One man in France spent the year 1743 inside a chimney, waiting for a bell to ring, so he could pull a rope through a pulley and hoist King Louis XV up in a flying chair from the ground to his bedroom balcony, rather than have him walk up a single flight of stairs. Elijah Otis was too sick for the family business. He was a good-looking kid and smart as a whip, but he was kind of a weakling. And when he was 19, he moved away from the family farm in Vermont to figure out something to do for a living. Something where he wouldn't have to exert himself. Sell anything bought or processed. Process anything sold, bought, or processed. Or lift heavy things. He wound up in a furniture factory, where he and his coworkers spent their days sanding curves and decorative knobs into bedposts. And Otis spent his nights designing a better way to do it. He invented a machine, a kind of lathe that sped up the process. It increased output, it made the men's jobs a little easier, and it opened up the aesthetic possibilities of the bedpost in new, thrilling ways. Knobs upon knobs upon knobs upon knobs. And his boss was so impressed that he took him off the floor and made him head engineer of the Mays and Burns Bed Factory of Yonkers, New York. So Otis got to work trying to solve one of the biggest problems in the place. The factory had a lift. It had an elevator. A lot of factories were starting to have them then. These were simple machines. Just picture a platform that could be pulled off the ground up to a second story on a chain or a set of cables or ropes. Sometimes the ropes would be pulled by a steam power winch. But the one in the Mays and Burns Bed Factory of Yonkers, New York, was pulled by a draft horse. And one day, the horse is pulling on the rope, which is pulling the wooden platform loaded with lumber and tools up to the second floor. And the rope snapped. The platform plummeted, dropping 15 feet, slamming down onto the floor and onto one of the men below, sending its cargo careening, smashing into the scattering workers. Just a few years later, in 1843, Elijah Otis stood on a wooden platform, 30 feet off the ground. The elevator was loaded with lumber and tools and barrels, just like the one had been that day in Yonkers. And down below, on the floor, stood hundreds of gentlemen and ladies who didn't want to spend their night out in the town being crushed by construction equipment. They had come to the Crystal Palace exhibition to see the gathered wonders of the world. A massive structure of steel and glass had risen in Manhattan, where Bryant Park is today. It was America's first World's Fair, and New York was psyched. And the gentlemen and ladies, after walking through these sculpture gardens and the art galleries, found themselves in a great hall filled with industrial equipment. And while they stood on the floor of the main hall, moonlight streaming through the glass roof, craning their necks to see Otis and his elevator floating in air, they may not have known that they were looking at the future. Because they had seen elevators before, and seen one inventor after another come up with some new way to get from one floor to another. So here was one more. Admittedly, he was higher than they'd seen before, up 3 stories instead of 2. But there was no way this thing was going to catch on. Because who in their right mind was going to ride a 3-story elevator? Fall from the 2nd floor, break your leg. Fall from the 3rd, you break your neck. So they watched Otis, and watched his son nearby, raise a sword, and then bring it down like an executioner, slicing the rope that held up the platform. And the audience screamed. And then they cheered. Elijah Otis didn't invent the elevator. He invented the brake. The little metal piece that catches the car and stops it from plummeting if the cable that holds it up stops holding it up. Elijah Otis didn't invent the elevator, but his sons kind of invented the modern world. The Otis brothers convinced the world to aim higher. The tallest buildings back in the 19th century, the tallest buildings that weren't churches or lighthouses, which were all show-offy spires anyway, were just a few stories tall. In part, these buildings were held down by the lack of engineering know-how. But just as much, they were held down by stairs. People could only climb so many. So the brothers Otis came up with a killer sales pitch. Higher was better. They targeted hotels first, and convinced them to turn the idea of luxury, quite literally, upside down. Before the elevator, the best rooms were on the bottom floor. You didn't have to walk. Stairs were for suckers. But the Otis brothers convinced hotels it should be the other way around. The first floors were the one on the street, with the hoi polloi and their noise and their sweat and their fruit carts sticking in the sun. And worse, the horses and the things horses do. Wasn't a king's throne supposed to be higher than his servants? Wasn't a lord supposed to lord over? Why shouldn't the wealthy traveler be above it all? And the hotels bit, and they built high, and the wealthy travelers liked the view. And when it came time for them to build their next office building, they built higher still. And they bought from the Otis Elevator Company. Buildings grew. 3 stories, to 4, to 6. And the elevators grew better and faster, to the delight of passengers, who loved the thrill ride of hurtling 70 feet at speeds of 600 feet per minute, up to the penthouse on the 7th floor. But though the Otis safety elevator relieved them of the fear of falling to their dooms, it created a new concern. One ginned up in the papers, and in the esteemed pages of the Scientific American, which warned of the horrors of something called elevator sickness, acute dizziness and nausea, owed to the specious fact that when an elevator comes to a stop, not all of your organs stop at the same time. The best way to combat this, it seems, was to brace your head up against the ceiling of the elevator as it came to a stop, so all of you stopped at the same time. The regional headquarters of the Otis Elevator Company in my hometown is a 1-story building. I just always thought that was kind of funny. At another World's Fair in Chicago in 1870, a crowd gathered to watch a dramatic demonstration of the latest in elevator safety technology. Earlier that year, a 7-story building in New York became the tallest in the world, and it had every architect and every illustrator in the Sunday circulars drawing up visions of the cities of the future, with gleaming towers climbing, soaring 11 and even 14 stories. And though people had grown to trust the Otis brake at 4 and 5 stories, what would happen if something happened and you were up there scraping the sky? So the fairgoers went out to a field where another inventor had constructed a temporary elevator shaft, this one 109 feet tall, and they watched as passengers climbed to the top and stepped inside. And they watched as someone cut the rope to the elevator, and it dropped, plummeting for a few exhilarating seconds before it came to a slow stop, cushioned by a pocket of compressed air. And then the crowd politely applauded, the outcome never having really been in doubt, what with the wonders American inventors were coming up with all the time. And really, they had seen this trick at a World's Fair before. They may have been more excited, however, had they known that this same technique had been tested in secret in Boston not long before. And when the elevator car holding 8 volunteers dropped on command, the air pressure in the shaft that was supposed to cushion its descent blew out the walls of the elevator shaft, leaving nothing to stop the free-falling car but Massachusetts soil. Many bones were broken. Lives passed before eyes. All 8 of them nearly died. Something the 8 volunteers who climbed into the elevator in Chicago hadn't been told. The Burj Khalifa Tower rises 2,722 feet above the desert in Dubai. It has history's tallest and fastest elevator, an Otis. It travels 30 feet a second, taking you 124 floors in about a minute. Reviewers have called the experience mildly exhilarating.
The Memory Palace is written and hosted by Nate DeMayo. He releases episodes on a weekly basis, and you can find out how to subscribe to the show at thememorypalace.us. Nate DeMayo will soon take the Memory Palace on the road, performing stories live around the country. Fingers crossed that he'll stop by the Bay Area soon, but we're not sure yet. Though, if you happen to be in LA in early May, you'll have the chance to see him at Radiotopia's live event, along with previously unheard stories from Roman Mars from 99% Invisible, Helen Zaltzman from The Illusionist, and many more podcasters. More information at radiotopia.fm. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. You'll find The Spot under the Programs tab. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.